Want more insights, especially some positive ones, on finding Chinese business partners for your e-commerce business? Welcome to Global from Asia, episode number 81.
Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business from Hong Kong is broken down into straight up actionable advice. And now, your host, Michael Michelini.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Happy Tuesday morning. Today's show is going to be a much longer than usual one, but it's a pretty awesome one. So first, a quick message. My wife, Wendy, wanted me to share. Her good friend here in China runs a massive e-commerce shop and is looking to import baby products to sell and be a massive distributor. So also, she does a lot of other products too, but specifically baby right now. But even if you have other products, she's a pretty good person to know. So if you're interested or have connections, send me a note at mike@globalfromasia.com. Okay, and now for today's episode, we have Russell Smith talking about his experiences selling on eBay that went into Amazon, giving us some tips about China fulfillment, positive insights. I know some other shows we've had have been somewhat constructive. So he has a good Chinese business partner he's working with right now. He's going to share the real story of how it started and how it's going right now. And then after the episode, we even got some personal stories he and I talked about that I wanted to share. So stay tuned after. And now let's get into the interview. Okay, thank you everybody for tuning in to another Global from Asia podcast. We have with us today Russell Smith, my friend here. And just before we get on here, I just wanted to thank him publicly for helping out editing both of my first books. So thanks for that, Russ.
Hey, cool. No problem, man. I'm happy to help out.
I know you're an e-commerce expert, but you also have really good editing experience, and I appreciate that help. So thanks for that.
Yeah, sure, man. I mean, the content's good, and you're a good friend, so happy to help.
Sure. Great. And so we're both in China now, right? You just came back to mainland China. And
just came back. I'm up in Tianjin now. I was in Thailand for a year and a half. Just came back to China. Before that, in China for about 4 years.
Cool. And I think we were talking before today, and you're in the homeland of my favorite food. You're in Tianjin.
the Tianjin jianbing.
Yeah, the jianbing. That stuff. I don't know how to describe it, but it's kind of like usually it's a breakfast thing, right? Like it's like maybe we could put a picture on the blog or something, but it's usually like a pancake kind of folded with like egg
but pancake. not like an American pancake, which is quite soft and sweet, but they're quite dry, right?
Yeah, I like it. I don't like sweet stuff, but it's not sour, it's just kind of like I recommend somebody, at least people try it. Usually it's a more northern Chinese. It's harder to find out here in the south where I'm at. But
and you mean the ones with, they've got some nice sort of spring onions on them?
Yeah, I like those onions. Onions, and some, it's kind of like a rice crispy kind of thing in the middle. I don't know how to describe it. I think we'll try.
I didn't know it was a local food, man, until you told me. And then only I asked people around here, I found out actually it's from here.
So. Yeah, it's awesome, right? Yeah.
Yeah, man.
A little bit of fun stuff, fun facts before we get started here. And we're both have Chinese wives now.
We do.
So you're married now, and that's pretty cool. Congratulations.
I'm on the long-term visa. Did you make a blog post about that, or was it in the book? I remember reading something you wrote where you said that when you get stable long-term, the whole vision in China changes. What you're capable of thinking, like, rather than I need to update my visa in 3 months or I need to update my visa in 6 months, suddenly you think, oh, I can actually live here.
I think it's kind of become a trend in my writing lately, because I think I feel like I also had a post about focusing and morning miracle stuff. I listened with Hal Elrod. Yeah, it's been amazing. Like, I really am in the zone. I wake up, no snooze either. Just get up, get out of bed, 5:30 a.m. and in the zone.
Did you find that happened like immediately when you started waking up early, or did you need to get into the routine before that happened?
I think I was trying to wake up earlier, even before I heard about the miracle morning. Yeah. And then it was like, I think I used to be so lazy. I used to get up at like 8:30 normally. And then yeah. I moved it to 7:40, 7:40, 6:30. I remember I just did a 10-minute back, like 6:40 to 6:30. And it was usually like, it depends, like that's over like 3 months, 4 months.
Yeah.
And then it went back 6:30 to 6 and 6 to 5:30. And I've been at 5:30 about a month and a half now.
Yeah.
So
it's cool, man. I mean, respect for sticking to it, because I kind of got the idea from, like, I was listening to Tony Robbins. He's got the Hour of Power, you know?
Okay.
And it, I guess it's a similar thing. You like just set some time in the morning, you have a routine, you work out, you know, or you meditate or have some incantations or something.
Yeah, I think that's where, yeah, Hal Elrod mentioned on the, mentioned that he got it from Tony Robbins. So it's, it seems nice. Like, cool.
It works, man. I went through a whole phase in Chiang Mai. Well, when I lived in Phuket, I lived by the beach. So every day I'd wake up at 6, every single day. Because the first thing I want to do is go to the beach, man. I love it. And my whole life feels great. I feel so like positive and really productive. But when I got up to Chiang Mai, I kind of, don't know, the mood changed and I found out I really struggled. And actually in the end, now I'm back in the 9 o'clock wake ups, which is kind of disappointing. Yeah.
It's a, we you know, keep rolling with it and keep me posted. Hopefully if I can help. So,
cool. Yeah, man.
So let's get into our,
let's get going
here for everybody. So, you know, I think this kind of started with the, episode 66, which is the Wilson Blues podcast with the FTC, right. and you had left a pretty good comment, and you're in this e-commerce space, so we decided it would be great to get you on as a Westerner in China and working with the Chinese and working with these physical products. So great to get you here. Maybe give us let's get a brief intro of who is Russell Smith.
No problem. So the FTC episode with Wilson actually really interested me, because I'm trying to do something similar myself at the moment, which is basically the idea that the factories in China are, not all of them, but some of them, they're looking to partner up with Western people who have the ability to brand products and to sell products abroad, because actually a lot of the shipping options directly from China are becoming more usable and kind of, it's not perfect to ship directly from China, like it's a bit slower, but the options are there and like the expenses can be kept quite low. So that's how we ended up talking. I actually began in China teaching English. I came over here, I was traveling, and pretty much what I wanted to do was learn a language. And I just made a commitment, like I want to learn an Asian language because I like traveling in Asia and Chinese just seems like the most useful language to learn. So over I came, I went to Guilin Yangshuo, which is in the countryside, really beautiful place. And I lived there for a good 2.5 years teaching English, kind of like passing the years away. But then I came to that time where I was just like, okay, I want to do more with my life. And my whole idea at the time was just to do business. I have to like do something. And I figured, what can I do? I'm in China, stuff's cheap, stuff's expensive in England. So pretty much buy some stuff, ship it back to England, sell it on eBay. And I think you were doing some eBay at the beginning as well. Yeah.
We'll talk about that in more detail later, but eBay used to be the king of e-commerce, right? Everybody had to have an eBay store I remember it's totally seems to have changed now, but I built my e-commerce business off eBay, and I always try to drive traffic to my website from eBay and brand my store. But yeah, I mean, eBay was how I can really credit my e-commerce business too. So
for sure, man.
So that's
great. eBay was the one. And so, yeah, how I managed to make that work was I actually partnered up with a Chinese friend who, you know, he has a history of foreign trade and he had money to invest. And so we kind of pooled our resources and just went in together. And that was probably 3.5 years ago, maybe not quite, about 3 years ago. But pretty much what's happened in that time is that, as you said, eBay used to be kind of easy. You know, you just chuck some stuff up and get some sales. We were just adding products as we found them, generic products. We kind of made a mistake in the day of not really branding very well, which is where I'm at now, pretty much trying to brand my goods and kind of noticing the trend of everyone switching over to Amazon, right?
Yeah, FBA. Exactly. True that. I mean,
and that's the huge, yeah.
Yeah, so it kind of goes into our next topic. I mean, you're kind of going into it a little bit now, but yeah, this transition. So how has this transition from eBay and Amazon been for you?
Yeah, it's tricky. So we sell on Amazon now, and what we've had to do, we basically started branding our goods, which is easier than a lot of people think. I mean, this podcast maybe isn't the place for it exactly, but pretty much if you're white labeling, you pretty much just put your own label on a generic product. You can change it, you can improve it, but what you also can do is just buy generic stuff and put your brand on it, which is the road we went down for most of our products. And once you do that on Amazon, you get the buy box because you're the only one selling your brand. And actually for us at the moment, Amazon's still outperforming eBay, but we're not doing quite as good as we think we could because we're not in FBA, and that's the difference. And we've got our own third-party fulfillment, which in a way is another benefit of partnering with a Chinese. I use a Chinese company that's kind of more for later. And so the tricky thing is with Amazon is if you're not in FBA, then I guess the sales are not as much because the users can't use Amazon Prime. And if you signed up to Amazon Prime, you get free shipping for anything that's in FBA and all these other kind of benefits. But so that's pretty much the hardest thing, I guess, with the inventory business is shifting our inventory. We also ship for our own website and we still sell on eBay. So we've got one warehouse shipping to all the places. That's the challenge there.
Cool. Yeah, honestly, I think people know listening. I'm not actively in e-commerce now, but I was there when Amazon was really picking up, and we were selling on Amazon too and eBay and our website, and of course it's also hard managing all these channels, right? Managing all these different, you know, for inventories, sure. and order and customer service, and but yeah, so
for sure, man, and stock, keeping in stock,
exactly. I had to bank loan and a family loan of like totaling like 50 grand. And that was pretty scary. And yeah, try to make sure you're up, not upside down, because you're selling the products and you're making money in a bank, but you got your loans. So you got to try to make sure you're, you know, cause it looks like you're making money sometimes, but yeah. So, I think my mistake was I had too many SKUs. So I was just, okay. That was something I don't like having too many stock items to keep track of, but so
we made this exact same mistake at the beginning, man. We bought, I won't say exactly what the products are, but we bought as many different sizes as we could, as many different colors as we could, as many different variations, and we bought four or five of each so we could have a huge range.
Yeah,
and of course, man, you sell three and suddenly you're almost out of stock, and then you sell two, and that's out of stock, and that one's one left. What we should have done was buy a few products and buy loads of them.
Exactly.
I mean, you have to do a certain amount of market research before you do that. Things would be different if we'd done that.
Yeah, the tough thing about that, at least, you know, I think people know I was in the bartending supplies, and you know, the customers want to buy like five different SKUs. So if you don't have one, they'll maybe go to your competitor to buy them, even though, you know, they might like your products. You want everything. So at least that's what my research was telling me. But anyway, enough about my nightmare there. Let's go forward.
Yeah.
So fulfillment, this is always a hot topic, and you kind of talked about a little bit, but FBA and third party and just generally in fulfillment, what are you recommending or
sharing? So my experience seems different to a lot of people that I talk to. So I can't comment on a lot of these ones, like Send from China, Ship Hero. I haven't actually used them. I know a lot of people use these kind of third-party companies, and you know, they seem great. I can't comment. What I'm connected with, because I partnered up with a Chinese, I'm actually using a Chinese company. I was using one called Zhukoyi. We can link it in the notes. And sure. I think they're an all right company. We actually ended up switching to one called Bird System, which we can link in the notes as well. Basically because they offered us 2 years free warehousing in the UK. So we said, cool, give it a try. You know, the rates were comparable and we get free storage for 2 years. So sure, we jumped at it. And but the funny thing about these companies is they pretty much operate in Chinese for Chinese sellers. So all the eBay guys you see, you know, the Chinese guys on eBay that are selling pretty much everything, most of them are going through these companies, which we use now, and they offer really cheap rates. And pretty much they offer a complete service from the factory in China to the customer in the UK or the USA. They've got warehouses in Germany now, which is pretty tidy, man. We, you know, what we have to do is figure out the products in the factory. Then we ship them to Shenzhen. When they get to Shenzhen, they arrive at the company warehouse, bird system that we're using now. They're scanned on. We can see the stock is in on the system. Then we choose if we want to ship by plane or by sea freight. They handle all the import and that kind of thing. Then they've got a warehouse in England. Once it arrives in England, the stock goes live on the system. We can see it's gone live. We sell it. Orders go straight to them. They fulfill. They deal with Royal Mail, USPS, all the shipping companies.
Amazing.
I mean, it's hassle-free pretty much. There's limitations. There are limitations to those kind of things. Like, we're not in FBA. That's the biggest limitation. It's just the fact that we're not in FBA. And a certain amount of inflexibility, because we have to pre-pack everything before we send. So, you know, everything's packed up in its cardboard mailer. So, like, if we sell a batch of 3 or 4 or 5, then they're going to arrive in 4 or 5 different boxes, which kind of sucks.
Yeah.
Or they have to open them up, repack them. We haven't seen it. We don't know for sure how that's going to look. And also the other thing is, like, inserts. You can't, like, this week we're going to have a deal, man, 10% off. We're going to put leaflets in all of them. Mm. We can't do that because we pre-packed them months ago.
Wow.
So yeah, pros and cons, man. It's cheap, convenient, and kind of strange. When I talk to them, often they're not even very interested in taking on foreign clients because they're so overwhelmed with how many Chinese want to ship abroad and sell on Amazon and eBay. So that's been my experience with those. I mean, I honestly think if someone was going to do Amazon, then I would just do FBA. It looks really good. I know a bunch of guys that are doing it, and it just looks very simple, a lot of benefits. So I would honestly recommend that. But if you're partnering with a Chinese, and you're trying to do something a bit more kind of in your own way, then there's these great options out there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't want to be, you know, saying I know, but I remember, I think usually the third party fulfillment is cheaper than FBA, but I guess, of course, you're not going to get that extra boost of sales from Amazon, right? So it's just easier, but I think it's not cheaper than what you're using, right? Yours is definitely cheaper.
Yeah, real cheap. That's the thing. We're saving money.
So it's a trick, because you save money, but you're not getting all the sales. Yeah. So you don't know what the
it's hard to balance that.
Interesting.
Well, this is a question, man, that I've got. If anyone's listening has the answer, I'm sure I could look it up somewhere. But my biggest question why I didn't go in FBA at the beginning was because when things get shipped from Amazon, they arrive in the Amazon box. So I didn't want to sell on eBay and have like an Amazon box arrive or sell on my own store. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
Someone might, because that'd be kind of a game changer.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I actually never use FBA either, so I wonder.
Okay.
So yeah, maybe somebody we can or comment on those notes, or we'll give you guys we'll give them a shout out on a future show for the answer.
Yeah. So I guess this isn't the podcast for like the Amazon.
There's lots of details,
but yeah.
Well, Amazon doesn't ship from China, right? You're still responsible to get it to a US or European warehouse. They're not going to take care of it from China. So you're also saving money, but you're also not having to deal with imports, exporting from China to UK, right? They're taking care of all that.
Exactly right. They take care of all that stuff. Literally all we have to do is ship to Shenzhen, which is internal in China.
I'm thinking here, so you don't have a cost to ship on ocean, or how do they charge you for that?
Well, yeah, we've got a cost. You know, we pay them for that service still. It's still competitive. Like, I'm sure you could save money if you went on your own way, and but then we pay a little bit more, but we get the fully inclusive service, which you kind of pay for convenience.
Got it.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, and then we were talking to, I guess Wilson had some, we can, people listen to his show. He was talking about a couple other options and, you know, I think, that's all I have for this point, right? The fulfillment.
Yeah. Well, I guess you mentioned Wilson's options. Do you mean like shipping directly from China to the customer?
Yeah, I mean, that's another option. True. Is that something you've thought about? Or?
Yeah, we do that. We do that for US orders. Sometimes we get US orders and actually it's cheaper. And sometimes faster to ship directly from China to the US rather than shipping from our UK warehouse. Because maybe I didn't mention all the stuff we're doing so far is basically in the UK. So it's Amazon, co.uk, eBay, co.uk. Yeah, when we get a US order straight from China, we wrap it up in a bag and it can cost us, I mean, anything, it tends to change, anything 60 cents to $3.
Interesting.
Pretty much. Yeah.
And then that's from your own factory, your partner's factory, or is that from the fulfillment center of these fulfillment companies?
That's from the office. We've got an office in Jiangsu.
Okay, got it.
So our system is we buy from the factory, which ships to the office in Jiangsu, where we inspect the goods and just make sure everything's legit. And then we send those goods to Shenzhen.
Okay.
And we always keep some stock in Jiangsu, so anything that happens... And those services, I mean, if people want to check them out, we can link them in the notes. There's Yiyoubao, and I mean, Yiyoubao and Guojixiaobao, which basically means international small bag or e-packet. We can try and find some links and send them, but they're really interesting. And you probably need to partner with someone or work with the Chinese because it's based on subsidies, I believe. Maybe Wilson could help us out.
Yeah, or somebody can set up the service, I think. It's amazing. Right. They don't even want to bother. It's just somebody has to make an English interface, right?
Right. Basically. Yeah. But they're so overwhelmed with Chinese interests. I mean, it's just many selling.
Sure, but somebody could make a middleman position in between. And
they really could. Like, by the way, you can send from China for quite cheap.com.
Okay. Yeah. There's still massive. I think it's basically under this category of cross-border e-commerce. I know like 500 Startups is an investment fund, and Dave McClure, I've heard him speak a few times, and they always say like cross-border e-commerce is a hot industry they're looking at, it's definitely interesting stuff. The global e-commerce. So
yeah,
definitely something that people should keep an eye on.
It's interesting, man. I mean, and just if, say, guys like me and you, we wanted to send the cheap stuff from China, it would probably be quite hard because you can't just go down to the post office. You have to have a kind of, you know, like a contract deal with the local post office, or it depends kind of like what subsidies. I'm sure, like, I mean, I know Shenzhen, Guangdong province must be one of the best places to get it.
There's tons of, like, I think I work with an app company now. Socially, I joined an app company and we're starting to sell some e-commerce stuff too from China. And there's too many choices. So what we do is we just kind of like, we keep stock in our office in Shenzhen, and then we just kind of like quote a few different companies and the prices are about the same. And then sometimes we just ship the piece for like 20 RMB to Huachanbei from Futian. So it gets there. So we don't have to even use their warehouse. We just ship it like a batch, like a 4 or 5 orders one day there. And then they take it and ship it internationally direct. So we don't have to have the warehouse there. But it's still something I'm just kind of experimenting with. We're mostly doing mobile apps, but I'm just kind of playing with some e-commerce as a new idea.
Kind of, when it becomes so simple, all you have to do is just pop up a site, make a sale, and you can just ship it direct from China. It's kind of almost too tempting not to give it a try.
It's tempting, right? You know? Maybe, I'm thinking even maybe this podcast site just pop up a e-commerce shop on. Try to sell some stuff, right? Cool.
Sell some podcast mics.
Some global from Asia, global from Asia. Yeah, microphones or something. All right. Yeah. So
cool, man.
I know you want to keep it actionable, but I think you have some more like general advice on maybe some items we're talking about, like F2C, and is there any other before we move to our next, the Chinese partner topic, or like I think is that enough? Or
yeah, I think that covers most of kind of the actionable stuff about.
Cool.
So, I mean, like I said, the FBA and the Amazon creating products in China. I mean, people can talk about that. On
we've
other
had
podcasts,
previous episodes about it. And,
right.
And cool.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say it leads on quite nicely, really, because the last thing I was thinking was the partnering with the Chinese, and that's probably the main topic.
So. Yeah. So you mentioned early on that you a few years ago was a Chinese friend and became a partner. So maybe just give us the story more of how this deal came to be.
I mean, referencing your book again, I remember there was one point in the Hong Kong book, I think, where you went to the trade shows and you were passing out business cards, picking out business cards, and you're adding everyone to QQ.
That's a
great way. You end up with this huge list of people and you just kind of stay in touch. You know, you just kind of every few months, they're quite good at, hey, how's it going? Cool. Everything good with you? Yeah, cool. Where are you now? You know?
Yeah.
And often those like mini friendships can bloom into something. Suddenly you're both in a position where you can work together and you kind of know each other. And that's pretty much what happened with my business partner too. He had a company before, a foreign trade company, and for whatever reason, that sort of stopped trading, and he went off to Yangshuo, which is where I was, and he spent some time in the English school. He was actually volunteering there, having a few months off, and we became friends.
Okay.
You know, we'd started talking, and probably it was a year later, I wanted to sell on eBay, and I was just thinking, okay, buy in China. Contacted a few factories. I didn't feel very confident. I didn't know anything. All I knew was, you know, hey, I'm in China and stuff's cheap, so this should be easy, right?
Sure. Yeah. We've all had that. I mean, you just helped edit the second book where I have my couple of my nightmares in there. It sounds easy at the beginning. I think it gets complex, so really keep it going for a longer term.
Sure.
And whatever you're comfortable sharing, but maybe some you could talk about what your role is as like the Westerner or what the Chinese side is bringing. And
sure, I mean, how things were when we started and then how things panned out in the end were quite different. The original deal was like, it was very simple. I mean, back then I didn't really know much about any kind of business. Like I said, I just wanted to do some business. So I just said to him, man, you know, I need a Chinese partner. We should work together. You know, the classic kind of 50-50, like you can speak Chinese, you've got the experience of foreign trade. And also I need an investor. Like I didn't have money to just buy stock up front. So actually, I contacted a few different people that I knew, and he kind of shone through. So, and what I could provide in my mind at that time was, hey, I've got knowledge of the Western market. I've got an idea for a product. You know, I can set up the eBay, I can set up the Amazon, that kind of thing. And, you know, it was kind of an amateur deal. We just went 50-50 straight down the middle on that, which is, I think maybe that's kind of coming back to a thing about the F2C where they've got the product, they've got the ability to like get those products and like ship the products, but maybe they just don't have the skills of developing a brand. You know, what does a Western logo look like? What does a Western logo company name sound like? What does the packaging look like? Because it certainly isn't the same as what a product looks like in China. So kind of, I think as like the Western part, like the biggest knowledge that you can bring is just the vision and the what do you call it? Kind of the ability to just build a Western-looking product that you think is going to sell on the Western market, pretty much.
Sure. Yeah, they're always.
Yeah.
You know, Chinese are, I think, very hard. I have a lot of Chinese friends, and obviously I'm married to a Chinese, so I'll try to say it nicely. But they're always They're always learning, and I think, and sure. They're very carefully taking notes, and I know a lot of like marketing friends, internet marketers, like listeners of the show that sometimes get called in to do, you know, they're doing consulting and they're like, I just kind of warned some people to you know, don't give too much advice for free, you know, because that's very valuable, like you said. So we have to
big time, man.
Yeah, like that, what we think is kind of like obvious about coloring and naming and position, brand positioning is something that the Chinese are still early stage at. So that's definitely very valuable asset.
Something I'd add to that as well is like, I agree with you, but I'd also say that rather than saying they're kind of behind on it, it's just different, isn't it? Like what a Chinese person thinks a product looks like or a website. Think about the difference between a Chinese website and a Western one, where we like a lot of, we like it very clean. We like to use space, really simple, big buttons. And when a Chinese, in general, I'm generalizing, but when they see a site like that, they think, oh, nothing there.
Yeah.
Like, this empty, what's happening? But you look at one of their kind of popular websites, packed with words,
exactly,
from top to bottom, left to right, jammed with words, flashing icons, you know, yeah, and they think, oh, good, something's happening. Cool. This is obviously the place to be.
Sure.
There's loads here. I think, and so I guess kind of similar maybe with the packaging design as well.
I think your Chinese is much better than mine, but I think also just a bit default, there's no space between words in Chinese. In Chinese. So I think I remember I had a friend that was Chinese, just moved to America, and when I was in school, grade school, and he was getting in trouble because he would write words without spaces between it, and he had to learn it. So yeah, sometimes there's signs in English on in China with no space between obvious
you
words.
Just see all the letters just jammed together. Yeah.
So that's another thing.
It's just just a different cultural idea of what looks good, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things you can bring as a foreigner, just the ability just to create a product that just, because it's kind of easy, even if you're not like versed in design, you can just kind of say, no, that looks bad, that looks bad. Oh, that looks good. Cool. You know?
Sure, exactly. even saying what's not, because of course we all know there, sometimes Chinese don't know how to do something, so they'll copy, which of course makes Westerners upset, but maybe it's also because they don't know, like you said, or don't know the Western ways. So they think if this one's successful, I just maybe change it a little bit and I can be successful. Sure. So yeah, it's a culture. So yeah, we have a list, you know, a lot of different like items to discuss on this, and it's tough to, of course, cover this in one podcast, but so
I mean, we could just go over it quickly. I guess I kind of had
You have some great
idea
points
to share, the things, kind of the benefits of partnering up with a Chinese, and then some kind of things to look out for, not like negative aspects, but just things you might not be aware of. So
sure. So I could read off some of the ones we've talked about. You have here.
Sure, man.
So of course, there, you said like the language and the culture of access to the factories and pricing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the first one. Like I said, when I first came to China, when I was first doing business in China, I just didn't know really anything about factory communications. And having that Chinese business partner with you just to jump on the phone to talk to them, it just makes everything a lot smoother, you know. You kind of can, I like to think that I'm sure that I'm getting a good price. And it is kind of interesting. Sometimes we can contact the same factory. Like I'll contact on my Alibaba account and he'll contact on his Alibaba account and just kind of see how the response differs. And generally, you know, the prices are a bit lower for Chinese, but not as much as I would have thought, actually.
Interesting.
Not as much. Sometimes people kind of think, oh, you know, they're going to give me like a super high price, but it's not really. Sometimes it is.
Yeah.
But I don't know. In my experience, it's generally kind of ballpark, at least, you know, a bit higher.
Yeah. And this next point you have, I'm interested in, is the Chinese are willing to invest. So actually, I have some other experiences with that. I guess it depends. But yeah, I'm interested to hear this point.
That's I reckon, I mean, that must just be based on my experience, because I read your point as well, which was saying kind of they're less maybe willing. What was it you said?
I guess,
they're like less willing to invest, or
I guess maybe I was talking about it as an internet tech startup in China for social agents. Mm-hmm. So I had a couple of investment offers. This is for shares in a company that's already existing, and these are like more like VC angel investor, professional investors. Maybe I should clarify that even in what I said there. But yeah, maybe you're right with that. If they're dealing with physical products, I think it's also different because like with my case, I usually tell people don't try to raise money in China, but maybe that's for a tech startup because it's like, I think it's not a tangible good. I'm selling like a software service. So it's code and it's like brand. So they don't see the value. They're pushing me down really hard on the valuation where I think. I think the difference here, you're dealing with physical products that they own and they see, like they love buying real estate or education. Yeah. But yeah, I think if you sell some intangible service or software or code, I think it's a different type of thing.
Yeah. So, cool, man. I think that might be the point because.
Well, maybe you should share. For the listeners, I don't think they know what my, maybe just share your story a little bit. So it's with the investing and the products, which is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much. So I found I found like a few people that just, well, you know what? Here's another point. I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but I find that China, the people here just seem to have cash, whereas the people in the West seem to have debt.
Agree. I don't know when this started happening because I don't feel like this was like that when I first came here. But yeah, I just feel like they have suitcases cash somewhere that they want to use on something. But
every home, every family just seems, even like kind of poorer people, they just seem to have these cash reserves. Yeah. No one seems to be in like debt where we've got these credit cards, we've got these loans.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, very generally speaking. But I guess that's what I'm talking about. So,
like I said, with my inventory, I mean, I built my credit, I built my first e-commerce business on credit cards and loans.
Right.
So,
yeah. Yes. So when I partnered with him, he had cash lying around. He was already interested in foreign trade. He, you know, had a company before. And he really wanted to get involved in kind of the Western markets. So for him, it's like, hey, I've got this idea. I can't buy the stock, but we could do it together. He obviously saw the value in that. And maybe it's like what you said. I mean, the products are kind of a few dollars each. And when we spend, our first spend was £3,000. So that's like 30,000 RMB. We just bought a bunch of stock. But then we got 30,000 RMB worth of goods.
Yeah, so there's a tangible value.
Yeah.
Like I think it's different with like a tech startup where there's software engineers and code, whereas they don't I think it's about the trust. So I guess maybe I'm not going to speak for your specific case with your partner, but I think maybe not even just Chinese mind, but a businessman's mind is like at least I have an asset. If something goes bad, at least I have a physical tangible product to have. So maybe that's the other
difference.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I kind of had that as a mini point on like later in the podcast, which was maybe they're less willing to invest money in things that they can't see like an exact immediate return on.
It's a short,
someone can't say, look, you're going to make money. Yeah.
It's short term. Yeah. I think it's, again, we're both like, you know, white guys in China, and we don't want to, offend anybody. But yeah, I think it's just maybe the culture, and I won't speak for you, but I'll speak for myself. Is, you know, I think like the Chinese, of course, there's like the 5,000 years of history they talk about, but there's also, as far as the new China is very young. And so I think the history is like, maybe there won't be a chance later to make money or so I'm going to try to get my money now rather than 10, 30, 20, 30 years from now. I don't know what the future is going to be. I think that's like the subconscious mindset, maybe.
It's kind of like the driving force. I mean, I've seen that too, man. I totally agree. Whether I can speak for like every Chinese, like I said, we're just a couple of white guys in China, so what do we know? But I mean, some Chinese people, I mean, it's just some, but they've told me that. And yeah, they've got a very recent history. Like, you know, the Cultural Revolution really is just like a generation or two ago, man. It's just around the corner. And there's so much change in China. Like, things change all the time.
Exactly.
There's no certainty that like what the rule is today will be the rule tomorrow. Yep. You could wake up and everything's changed because it's happened in people's lifetimes, maybe several times already. Yeah. And so, you know, if there's $10 on the table and you can take it now, or you could leave that $10, maybe you're going to get $100 next week. Take the $10, man. You know, there it is.
Yeah. I think honestly, like, I've been here too long, and I start to think, I think that happens to Westerners even. We are also, maybe I don't want to speak for both of us, but I kind of start adapting to that shorter term thinking too, and saving money, and okay, let's move forward.
Cool, moving on.
So again, I think your point here is someone to kind of like make, I'll kind of combine these, make you feel at home and help you with a cultural knowledge company setup kind of things.
Yeah, I mean, it just really helps when you're far away from home to have someone just saying, no worries, man, I'll book you a train ticket. No worries, I'll book you a hotel. You know, true. Just to the value of that, like partnering with the Chinese, and they're really good at making you feel at home. They're almost like aggressively friendly, you know?
Yeah, they really want to be responsible to make sure a Westerner has a good experience in their country. Like the dinners, I would sometimes go to factories that I had no real reason to buy from. Maybe I shouldn't put this in the but I wouldn't do it purposely, but there was maybe a chance I might buy some product, but they would take you to the nicest restaurant, treat you and talk about their culture. But they would also, I would even sometimes tell them, like, I'm not sure if I'm really going to buy anything. And they would say, well, we just want to, you know, show you our home country, our culture. They're like trying to make us know they're not a bad, you know, not bad people. They're good people and they take care of their guests. So that's for sure.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think just generally hospitality in China is just seen, it's just very important. Yeah. They're very good at kind of making you feel at home. And it's really, it also reflects on them. Like, are you having a good time with them? Like in their house, in their family, in their company, in their factory. Are you having a good time? Metric that they're.
I can see you with some Baijiu shots here. And
I tell you what, I'm getting into Baijiu now.
Yeah. For those not sure of that, it's, I call it like rubbing alcohol, but it's like a very strong white wine, or like more like a, I guess like a vodka or kind of like very strong, clear alcohol. So
I guess there's no space for anything else. It's just white liquid and alcohol.
Yeah. All right. Go ahead.
No, the closest thing I think of it is like a lot of people are familiar with sake maybe in Japan, which is their rice wine.
True. So, if you guys like, listeners like drinking, come to China and go to some factories, and they'll take care of you.
They'll take care of you for sure. Yeah. And yeah, so I mean, the stuff about the Chinese company, the only thing with that is, I know you had like some quite extensive experience setting up companies in China or getting a Hong Kong company just so you can have an office and employ staff, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm working with a Chinese guy. He's already got his own company. We used his previous trading company. We used that. We set up an office. We employed staff. So for me, it was
hands-on. Definitely easier. But again, I think just my own little warning for listeners, you knew him and had a relationship with him that you worked on over some time. So that's the difference. Like, you know, whether it's a Chinese business partner or any business partner, really, like, it takes time to get to know them. So I'm not going to just call it Chinese business partner, but anybody, it's like, you know, getting married. Some people say it's even more formal than getting married. Like, you know, it's a big decision. So yeah, like
the marriage model.
I was always, for me, I set up a woofy or a wholly foreign owned entity just cause, you know, I was always cautious. I came here and I didn't have a business partner right away and I didn't want to rush into it and I wanted to do business. And, but yeah, of course, like it's an advantage if you have a trusted business partner that you have a relationship with and I totally agree with you that they'll take care of all that.
I was thinking about this before, like the trust, because obviously, I mean, contracts aren't so big here. So a lot of it is on trust and on the kind of the network, I guess the Guanxi network. a lot of people are kind of held by that, I feel. You know, if they make a mistake or they let someone down, then kind of the whole network's going to end up finding out.
Mm-hmm,
people
mm-hmm.
are more kind of bound by that
yeah.
rather than their word. And I tell you what, I guess the reason that I can trust him is because I wasn't invested in terms of cash.
True.
I hadn't, you know, I was invested in terms of time.
True.
But I hadn't laid down my cash in the business. And had I done that, maybe the story would be a bit different.
True.
Yeah.
I'm a lot of things to consider,
I guess.
I'm really happy it's working for you, but even though you might not put money in, you're building, like you said, the brand and the brand equity, which maybe.
Well, yeah. And that's a whole nother thing because we're not actually necessarily putting the brand. That doesn't have any connection to the local company.
We just use
that company to open an office
and employ some staff
to pack the boxes. So
Got it.
Yeah, sure. There's no actual attachment. I mean, technically, I've got nothing to do with it.
Okay. All right. Cool.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff's always so case by case, you know.
Exactly.
Of course, everybody listening has to feel comfortable themselves and know what's right. So I think we should just go on from there.
Sure, man.
So I like your last point here on the positives. I think we kind of touched on this earlier, but you say like very, very hardworking. So
hardworking. They work hard.
Yeah. I think like if you go to any Chinatown in around the world, you can see that, right? So
yeah. I mean, I don't know where that comes from. Maybe the school system, maybe everything. I mean, they're good at working hard. They put in hours at the computer and they kind of don't question it so much. They just
go.
Well, what do you think of this, man?
Go ahead.
This might just be my personal experience, but I thought like where they work hard, then we're trying to work smart. And I know that we need to work hard as well as work smart, but you know, the kind of difference.
Yeah. I think I've been trying to work on optimization. Like we, a very, very early show today, I was talking about waking up early, but it's not like I stopped working early either. But, you know, I think that's the Western mentality is maximizing productivity and output, mm-hmm. where I think maybe the Eastern or Chinese thinking is work hard. And, you know, I think it's even maybe I'll think back to my dad or my older, you know, even older generations in the West. Like I think they work on, you know, in America used to have, for me, America had factories and they would just work and hit nails into a widget, right? And get paid.
Right.
And they would work hard and get paid. But I think it's because of our generation in the West now is moving to more the digital and service based. So there it's like you can work really hard, but if you're going to excel and adding one by one each box rather than using a formula to take a total, then you're like, then it's not smart, right? But
there's only so much you can grow. There's no kind of exponential growth possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, for sure. And I think that kind of links back to what we said about what we can offer, like as Westerners. Maybe it's kind of our innovation, our ability to kind of work smart, sort of try and build these systems to put the systems in place to let that kind of exponential growth happen.
Exactly.
Whereas they're still wake up in the morning, grind. Go to bed at night, wake up in the morning, you know,
get it done.
And not in a bad way, man, because it's been really inspiring for me to work alongside that and realize how many hours a day it's possible to work.
Yeah.
Which I don't, to be honest.
Yeah, I understand. So I guess it's a good match, right? You're balancing these two sides to get the best mix of the both.
Yeah.
So
I guess, cool, man. I mean, I guess we're leading on to the things to watch out for.
Yeah, this is the more fun part. So those that lasted just a little bit longer podcast than normal, but you know, I think it's a good one. So here's the sensitive one that maybe Russell's making what he says. But
just to be clear, we're still in business together. Everything's
cool. You're a positive case. So yeah,
sure,
so this is some things to consider when you're
finding
a partner. Yeah, I think it's a good one. So, yeah, I guess your point here is the cultural understanding of what things quote unquote mean.
Right. For example, quality, good, fast, reliable, you know, this is just my experience and not really even necessarily talking about my business partner, but just all my friends in China. When you say, cool, man, we're going to create a good quality product, you look each other in the eye and you both go, yes, that's what we should do. I kind of feel like, I don't know, I mean, this is just my experience, but I kind of feel like if I was talking to an English friend, we would both in our mind have at least a similar ballpark idea of like what good quality means based on all the products that we've bought in the past, maybe. And but sometimes with Chinese, I guess you just have to clarify, like, what does make a good quality product, you know?
Yeah.
How are we judging that?
Yeah.
It's just something I think you should just, you know, be aware of. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Be specific, right?
I think like with all this white label brand, private labeling, a lot of times I think a Chinese factory thinks that Nike, for example, Nike is making all this money because they just put a logo on the sneaker, right? They don't realize all the branding and imaging and quality that went into that. So they, a lot of times you'll see these fake Nike, like just say Nike, for example, see fake Nikes and they think that they'll sell well. It's because of the name, which they will, because the name has value. But of course, when someone gets that bad quality, that hurts Nike, of course. And Nike doesn't want that.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of times even Westerners, but some Westerners that don't have business experience think it's just the logo, but of course it's the whole experience. It's the making that, you know, the product's going to be a good product, you know, that
for sure.
And everything, there's a lot more to a brand.
And I think like you said, probably the biggest one maybe is the experience and the membership of the group or the tribe. You know, when you buy Nikes, you're an owner of a pair of Nikes along with all the other owners of a pair of Nikes and everything that means. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that would and I reckon that's probably good advice for people calling out factories as well. You know, be specific. Saying things like good quality, reliable isn't good enough. You have to say like, I want it at this time, or, you know, specifically, when can you get it to me by, or stuff like that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think maybe having a physical sample of every product and trying to make sure that they understand that this one maybe have a good quality and a bad quality, and keep them like in the office next to each other or something.
Just so. Not this, or at least, like you said, every iteration, each time you make a change to a product, make sure you've got the final product in your hands. I mean, you know, a sample, and then say, okay, I want how many of those exactly the same.
Yeah.
You know,
cool. So yeah, I think I like this one. I'll call it go. Or this is just willing to go and worry about the details later is a lot of times sometimes happens in China. So you want to expand on that area?
I mean, yeah. So I found, I think at the beginning, I found this quite frustrating. I was expecting to sit down and spend some time and really talk about like, how the product's going to look, why it's going to look that way, how the marketing's going to go, what's the strategy, who's our target audience, how are we going to engage those people? Whereas in general, kind of the Chinese side was much more like, cool, these guys sell tons of this product, let's do it, you know?
Exactly. They'll look at the competitor on eBay and they'll calculate how much they've sold and then...
Right.
Yeah.
Which is kind of another point, maybe it's a similar point where they tend to follow in business. I don't know if you see it, even in China, they do that, you know, someone sets up a hardware shop and it's successful. Then suddenly there's three or four more hardware shops on the same street.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the mindset seems to be like, cool, it works, therefore let's do it. And like, again, not complaining. It's just my experience. Like, you know, definitely not saying it's kind of bad in any way, but it's something to be aware of. Like they're going to probably have that kind of attitude if you're going to be partnering up.
Yeah, I totally agree. And let's maybe go to the next thing here. And similar, we've kind of touched on this a little bit about saving money now or the short term.
Yeah, I guess we already talked about that, really. And maybe in specifics about the quality of, say, the packaging, or, you know, you often have a different level of like what materials you can use. So the difference maybe in the Western mindset and the Chinese mindset might be that the Western mindset might think, cool, it's worth investing in maybe the best or the second best, because what we want is good reviews. We want people to open the package and say, wow, this is genuinely really top notch. But then maybe the Chinese side might say, why would I basically buy the same thing for $2 more when I can buy it for $2 less and make $2 more for every sale.
Exactly.
That might be, yeah, that's probably going to be a common, and it could happen, yeah, with anything, the packaging, the quality of materials, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just, yeah, again, being clear with your business partner and your, or your supplier, well, even your supplier is in a way a partner. So yeah. About what is good and what, try to get them, yeah, to buy into the long term.
And interestingly, I'll tell you, like, I guess we're kind of like starting to round up a bit.
Yeah.
That's probably the last point, I think, because we kind of covered all the other stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can see.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. And so pretty much what happened for us is that we started, I should maybe say, kind of more in a Chinese way. I mean, if you looked on eBay at the start, you would think that my eBay account was a Chinese seller, pretty much. Huh. We just bought the cheapest stuff. We whacked it up and there it was, and I was selling it for cheap prices. I guess the interesting thing that happened was that long term, I had to kind of wait it out a bit. I had to kind of wait it out long term. And as it became apparent when we started to try and sell on Amazon, and also when the market got flooded, suddenly everyone was selling the same product. Mm-hmm. And because we weren't branded, there's nothing we could do. Everyone dropped their prices. Mm-hmm. Almost. I mean, there's still people on there now selling for almost less than we can buy it for.
Crazy.
So, yeah, what options do you have? You literally have no option except to brand it, say, this is my brand. If you want my brand, it's going to cost this much. So kind of for me, I had to wait it out until it became obvious, until literally the market showed us that we can't continue with the cheapest goods. We actually have to invest in something more quality. That's just how I got around that particular hurdle in the kind of relationship and the difference in opinion on quality. So long ball game.
Yeah, sure. I think it's true. I mean, I guess, I mean, any relationship, whether it's with a Chinese partner or this Western partner or spouse, you know, you need patience, I think, right? And I'll let them, of course, try to state your case, but sometimes, like, let them see what happens if, you know, not on a, don't let go out of control, but try to have like an example case maybe where they can see what happens if this goes in that direction, you know, try to give them like a forecast. So,
big time.
So thanks so much.
And that kind of links back. Yeah, no worries, man. I mean, I was going to say that kind of links back to what we said about them not willing to invest in something that they can't see like an immediate return on. If you can show them, if this, then that, then you have like something to work on. But if you can say, I think that if this, then that,
Or try to be, try to make them think it's their idea somehow. Like that's like some kind of, that's like a negotiation tactic, I think. But yeah, of course,
I've never tried that one, but
it's trickier. I don't want to say I've done it too often, but try to somehow align it so that they can discover it and then it's their idea. And
leaving clues around there.
Yeah. Cool. Well, of course, we appreciate it. Maybe can you share your website or how people can reach out to you for thanking you or further info?
Sure. Best place to contact me would be my personal website, russellleesmith.com.
Okay, cool.
It's not a lot there. There's a contact, and I do some consulting for China sourcing and for China business culture, if anyone's interested.
Awesome.
That's available there.
Great, great. I definitely recommend your service. You have a great, you're very helpful. So that's a wrap, and thanks again for being on.
I appreciate that, man. It's good fun. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Russell, for coming on and sharing so openly and so much. So I hope everybody appreciates it as much as I do. And I hope your business partner in China is listening too, because it's pretty awesome, and he's lucky to have you on board. So I wanted to mention something else about Russell. Before we started the interview, we were talking about life and marriage, and he mentioned that one of my blog posts was pretty influential in him with his recent marriage and girlfriend situation. And I'll link it up on the show notes, but I was talking about like visiting a girl's hometown in China, what that means, and marriage in China and love and things like that. And it's a little bit soft, but he might enjoy it too, because it's pretty powerful. Felt great that he liked it so much. And another thing that's pretty amazing is Russell and I still haven't met in person. We've done two books. He's helped me edit now, and we've done a lot of projects, and we talked a lot. So we look forward to catching up for a cup of tea face-to-face one day soon. Okay, and now we have an awesome new iTunes review. This one's pretty cool, and it got me to smile when I read it, so let me read it out loud for everybody here. 5 stars from user Rio Kine, and is titled Californian Living in Shanghai. And he says, "Hi, Michael. Wanted to give you a shout for your podcast. I'm from California and I spent about 5 years in China and Taiwan. I'm living in Shanghai at the moment and love listening to the podcast while I'm on the road. I'm always commuting to furniture factories in Zhejiang and Jiangsu provinces, and the podcast helps me get my mind going and gives me lots of inspiration and ideas. Appreciate what you're doing, bringing good minds together and speaking openly to the audience about topics we are all interested in. Keep it up, Greg McGrath." Well, thanks, Greg. Really appreciate it. And cool you put your real name in there, too. So it's great. Yeah, I mean, we're meeting lots of good people, and we'll have to do some events in the future because a lot of people coming through and meeting up. So keep listening, guys, and keep giving great feedback, and everything, even constructive or negative, helps me improve the show. And we got some great shows lined up. So next week, we'll have Fionn back on, talking about immigration for foreigners into Hong Kong. So you might want to be here for that one. And take care, guys. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
To get more info about running an international business via Hong Kong, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Thanks for tuning in.